Okay.
Got to get up early in the morning from Mark and Denise in the Mornings, of course. It's your host, Mark Kelly Tyler, along with Denise Clay, writer for the Philadelphia Sunday Sun, Philadelphia Magazine, Philadelphia Public Record. If you have it to be written, she will write it. What's up, Denise?
Not much. How about you?
I'm well. Back in the United States.
Yay! Well, yeah. I say yay because, you know, it's the... Forget I said that.
Well, I was not in Europe with Trump, no.
No, because, you know, why would you want to be a part of National Lampoon's European Vacation?
No, I was not there. You know where I would have, where I would not have minded to have been is in Cape Town.
Oh.
President Obama spoke. That was actually exciting.
Yes, today would have been Nelson Mandela's 100th birthday. And the former president was in Cape Town yesterday. And I think he's still there. He did a town hall with some South African young people today. Or at least that's what popped up when I got up this morning to come into the studio. He's as part of the Obama Foundation. They've been doing some work in South Africa with African young people who are community leaders and stuff. So he gave the Nelson Mandela speech yesterday at an event they had that was 2.5 hours long. And from what you were telling me, most of it was introducing Barack Obama.
What did I tell you? Look, I am African American by way of Africa many, many years ago. But as an AME, we harbor many of those traditions deep down. And one of the ones that we deeply respect is protocol. Mm-hmm. And having, you know, you have to hear from the elders, from, you know, the bishops, so to speak, the leaders, Mm-hmm. And in that case, presidents and heads of state and everybody's got to get their shot in. And we get it beforehand because you know what? We all know, at least in our tradition, when the keynote speaks, everybody rolls out. So if you don't say what you have to say before they speak, it's a wrap. Mm-hmm. Other cultures may be different, but we're going to get ours in beforehand.
Well, that's good.
How long did it take before he got up yesterday?
Well, the event started at 8, and President Obama got up there at – when they were showing the speech live, it was like 8:45 our time. So I guess, you know, the 1 hour and 45 minutes was kind of fast. But the speech that he gave was one of those speeches that, you know, I was on my Facebook timeline watching it, and you had all of these people who pretty much said the same thing. You know, we miss you. We miss your ability to, you know, communicate effectively. We miss your, you know, we miss your class. We miss your integrity.
Not embarrassing us.
Yes, we miss having somebody that doesn't embarrass us. But here's the thing, and this is what always cracks me up when, you know, we have, you know, these, you know, I miss Obama listening parties, is that, you know, you guys kind of treated him like crap when he was here. You know, some of you were the same people who didn't vote in 2010 or 2014 and handed him a Republican Congress that had decided that they weren't going to do anything to help him out and thus, by extension, help out the country. And, you know, some of you are some of the same people who said, you know, I didn't get my pony from President Obama, so I'm walking away. So, you know, while I can understand that now you miss him because you have seen the alternative, I'm like, you know, you kind of need to sit down somewhere.
Because you're not hearing it, Denise.
Well, I know that. I know that. Like I said, I'm kind of at the point where I'm tired of seeing people so woke that they're insomniacs and they're bumping into stuff. There are a lot of folks out here who need to take a nap, a long nap.
So, folks, you heard it from Denise. She is not feeling you. If you weren't down before, don't try to get down now. And but it was a good speech. The parts that I heard, and we're gonna play a clip of it. NBC actually put together kind of like a highlight reel, so to speak. We're gonna play a part of that. I think it's their national networks page. But before we do that, do want to say, kind of lay out the show for you today. In the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to speak to hip hop artist and now filmmaker, mm-hmm. Boots Riley, mm-hmm. from Oak Town, my homeboy, who has the new hit film, Sorry to Bother You, which in a lot of ways, Denise, so you've seen it. I haven't yet because again, Leslie and I just got back in the country and so didn't have a chance to, it wasn't playing where we were. Mm-hmm. But just the preview alone, help me if I'm wrong. But it seems a lot like a modern take on Richard Pryor's 70s film, late 70s, early 80s, Which Way Is Up?
In a way it is. It's kind of, you know, Which Way Is Up mixed with the Twilight Zone. A little parable of the sower thrown in. You want to go see this movie with a group of your friends and you want to figure out where you all are going to get together and have coffee or a meal or a drink afterward, because you're going to want to discuss this. You are going to want to talk about Sorry to Bother You, because the performances were great. You know, you can tell that this was, you know, pretty well thought out. But there is a lot to unpack with this movie. And
interesting.
And while I won't get into, you know, I won't get into too much about it because I'm saving that for when Boots Riley joins us, treat it like a Marvel movie in some ways. I'll just say that.
Oh, okay.
Treat it like you would a Marvel movie.
Got it. So you have to suspend some belief, but there's a greater message involved.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we're looking forward to that. That's going to be a great conversation. And he's got a long, I mean, so if you know, or if you look at his body of work, I mean, you know, I think kind of words like subversive would come to mind. I mean, in a positive way, trying to really kind of bring people back to, you know, their roots. And again, he's out of Oakland. So, you know, he's going to be influenced by things like the Panthers and others. And so it'll be an interesting take to hear from him, kind of the seeds that were planted for this film. What's that, Denise?
I didn't say anything, yeah. But it sounded like Barack Obama did.
Oh, well, good. So listen, right. And Denise, we also want to talk this morning because we have found out who the third person was in the car that led to the stabbing death of a Philadelphia real estate developer and the arrest of a young Philadelphia college student in that stabbing. And it is not John Belaris. So everyone, please, it's not the weatherman. It was not John Belaris said on his post that he was with them before the stabbing, mm-hmm. didn't know about the stabbing till the next morning. He maintained that. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of rumor out there that it was him, but that's what happens when people don't come forward. It leaves a vacuum and people are going to fill it with something. Mm-hmm. So John Belaris is off the hook. He was not involved. But we're going to talk about that story as well. And talk about their hypothesize on why this person took so long, you know, to come forward. But everybody's lawyered up in this thing at this point.
Well, of course, whenever there's a murder involved, you're going to lawyer up because you don't want to end up going to jail for something that you might have been connected to, but that you didn't actually do.
Right.
And the thing is, because we've been talking a lot about, you know, at least on the internet, folks have been talking about whether or not he should have a private lawyer or if he should, you know, go the public defender route. And, you know, my thing is this. If you want him to get an actual private criminal attorney, people who keep, you know, having this discussion on my Facebook page, talk to the parents, start a GoFundMe account and work it from there. Other than that, you're basically dissing the Defenders Association right now. You're saying that they're not up to the task. And we have one of the best public defender organizations in the country. So I think that before you write them off, that you check that out. Because, yeah. First of all, this family was probably saving money for this kid to go to college. And, you know, it's easier to start a GoFundMe account for someone to go to college than it is for them to keep from going to jail. And, you know, unless these people ask you for help, mind your business.
Hey, I got an idea. How about all those high-powered, expensive attorneys who told us that they weren't just here because of Meek Mill, but they were interested in all the persons who were going through the system and not being fairly represented, and that they would surely help out? I wonder if they'd be willing to help out Michael White right now and defend him.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. That is a good point. All of y'all, you know, Johnny Cochran wannabes who were out there marching in the streets next to Meek Mill, if you want a hill to die on in terms of criminal justice, may I present to you Michael White.
You're right. This is the hill. I mean, because if there ever at least seemed to be a case where you really, really, really want to make sure a person, and this is, again, I'm not dissing Kier. I love Kier. Kier, we have her on the show as often as we can, and I know that they're competent and can handle it. The question is, do they have the resources and time, you know, to devote to one single case mm-hmm. in this way that's going to probably drag out for some time? Like it would if you hired your own personal attorney who's going to clear their calendar. This is a capital case. They're going to make sure they give you everything. So, again, I say, you know, like I said, as clergy, some of them came to us. Oh, we want you all to help us with Meek. And I'm saying, well, what about everybody else? Oh, we're definitely interested in them, too. This is not about Meek by himself. This is about everybody. Well, you know, Denise has laid out. This is the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Die on this hill.
I'm from Missouri.
And I mean,
show
really.
me.
Yeah, I mean, really, some of those big name New York attorneys and some here in Philadelphia that, you know, went out there and said, you know, repeatedly that this is not about the money. This is not just because me can afford it. Somebody ought to step up in this moment and say, I got you, Mike. I want to make sure that you get a fair hearing in this. And I, you know, I know Kier can do it. I know the defenders can do it, but I want to devote my time and my staff and my legal team to your defense in this moment. I'm waiting. Phone is open. 888-329-3306. If you want to break that news here first that, oh, I'm going to do it. I'm reaching out to the family. I got them.
Hey.
Anyway. So we'll talk about, we'll unpack that and we'll talk about the implications in the story that's out in the Inquirer this morning about Mr. Jacobson, the third person in the car. And we'll also talk some about the president has done something that he rarely ever does. That is to offer an apology of sorts.
Yeah, but then he turned right back around and said, you know, okay, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry. And
well, of course, again, will it last? I mean, so even this, even will the convoluted apology last? My guess is it won't make it half the day before he tweets out something, you know, that says, because if you look at the video or the photos from that meeting yesterday where he made the apology, he's sitting there with those arms folded mm-hmm. in that position. You know, that's always that position where it's like he's being made to do something. You mm-hmm. know that. Remember the Charlottesville, and he looked very uncomfortable when he made the apology, then came right back out and tweeted, take it all back.
Yeah, pretty much.
They were making me do it.
Pretty much.
Right. And I got a feeling by the end of the day that the real Trump is going to come back. And I mean, look, that's why his people love him, because he's the real Trump. He doesn't back down, doesn't apologize, even when he's wrong, never apologize. Never apologize. That's not American. And so I got a feeling we're going to have a tweet that will undo all of his would or wouldn't apology. But again, we'll get to that in a moment. Denise, since we have just like been bombarding people with all the bad stuff, let's hear a little bit of President Obama, courtesy of NBC's. We took this off of their YouTube page that they had posted. They put together some of the highlights of Obama's speech yesterday in South Africa. And let's remember the good old days. Cue the tape, Dan.
But given the strange and uncertain times that we are in, and they are strange, and they are uncertain, with each day's news cycles bringing more head spinning and disturbing headlines, I thought maybe it would be useful to step back for a moment and try to get some perspective. It's not wrong to insist that national borders matter. That's, you know, whether you're a citizen or not is going to matter to a government, that laws need to be followed, that in the public realm, newcomers should make an effort to adapt to the language and customs of their new home. Those are legitimate things. And we have to be able to engage people who do feel as if things are not orderly. But that can't be an excuse for immigration policies based on race or ethnicity or religion. There's got to be some consistency. And we can enforce the law while respecting the essential humanity of those who are striving for a better life. For a mother with a child in her arms, we can recognize that could be somebody in our family. That could be my child. Unfortunately, too much of politics today seems to reject the very concept of objective truth. People just make stuff up. They just make stuff up. We see it in the growth of state-sponsored propaganda. We see it in internet-driven fabrications. We see it in the blurring of lines between news and entertainment. We see the utter loss of shame among political leaders where they're caught in a lie and they just double down and they lie some more. If I say this is a podium and you say this is an elephant, it's going to be hard for us to cooperate. I can't find common ground if somebody says climate change is just not happening when almost all the world's scientists tell us it is. I don't know where to start talking to you about this. If you start saying it's an elaborate hoax, I don't know what to... Where do we start? As with the denial of rights, the denial of facts runs counter to democracy. It could be its undoing, which is why we have to zealously protect independent media. And we have to guard against the tendency for social media to become purely a platform for spectacle and outrage and disinformation. So young people who are in the audience, who are listening, my message to you is simple. Keep believing. Keep marching. Keep building. Keep raising your voice. Every generation has the opportunity to remake the world. Mandela said, young people are capable, when aroused, of bringing down the towers of oppression and raising the banners of freedom. Now's a good time to be aroused. Now's a good time to be fired up. Madiba reminds us that no one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion. People must learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart. Love comes more naturally to the human heart. Let's remember that truth. Let's see it as our North Star.
Hey, NBC News.
Wow. Remember those days?
Mm-hmm.
It's not so long ago.
But it feels like it.
Wow. I mean, it's like, can we just like play that on a continuous loop for the next 2 years? No, Donnie D, we can't change the law. He can't be president again.
No, because they put the 22nd Amendment together after Franklin Roosevelt did, I think, 3 terms as president. They decided, well, we can't have that. Although once Trump was elected, a lot of people started asking themselves, does this amendment still do what it needed to do? And, you know, should we reconsider this?
I know. I'll tell you. I'm telling you. I think actually FDR did a lot more than 3.
Oh, yeah. He was in the middle of his 4th when he died.
Yeah. Man, he ran the table. And let me tell you, if he didn't die after you lead a country through the Great Depression and World War II successfully, they'll let you. He would have been president, you know, probably until the 60s. I mean, seriously. Who's going to like vote that guy out? But yeah, you're right. So he can't. So blame it on FDR. He messed up for Obama. And so he cannot run again. But again, I think it's an important reminder. And so he laid so much out in that long speech. And again, thanks to NBC for stringing together some important highlights. And, you know, again, and I think it's also about the worldview that we choose to focus on. Right. One that says that, yes, the world is a scary place. So therefore, let's make it scarier, or the world is a scary place, but let's make it a less scary place. Mm-hmm. And it seems that that's kind of where, you know, he and Trump diverge, right? I mean, one that says it's dark, let's light a candle and lighten up the place. And one is it's dark. How can we make this darker? Mm-hmm. How can we make it more gloomy? And that's, I think, what people miss. It's not that the things that Trump points out are not true in some respect, right? With regard to immigration, people on both sides agree that there are issues with immigration and our laws and the way in which our borders are secure or not secure. That there's no disagreement there. There's no disagreement around, you know, indifferences with trade. with countries. And, you know, I mean, so some things are just some basic things, but that's not, that doesn't seem to be the issue. The issue seems to be where you take it from that point. Do we make it better as a result, or do we revert back to our, you know, deepest fear and anxiety back when we were all a bunch of individual tribes thousands of years ago? And I see you, the first thing I do is try to hack your head off because I think you're coming for what I have.
Mm-hmm.
It's called evolution. And, you know, evolution is not supposed to go backwards. It's supposed to go forwards, forward. So thank you, President Obama, for that speech on yesterday, or that lecture. And the next time you go to South Africa in the summer in the U.S., remember it's the winter there, so take your coat, bro. He said he forgot. He said he had on long johns yesterday. Had to send somebody out to get some for him.
Mm.
Yeah. So this is on the heels of Donald Trump's apology, so to speak. Are you buying it, Denise? He said essentially this, that when he said that, you know, why would it be Russia? He meant to say, why wouldn't it be Russia?
Mm-hmm.
I guess that clears it all up. Oh, okay. Slip of the tongue.
Whatever, man.
Huh?
Whatever,
you don't believe
man.
It?
No. Then again, if this man were to tell me it was raining outside, I would go out and look.
But he said it was a slip of the tongue.
No,
he
said,
I said
slip
would.
Of the tongue. You,
but I meant
you,
to say.
You said what you meant.
Wouldn't.
You said what you meant, homie. And you know, and if nothing else, after watching that press conference and watching how he's conducted himself since, or better yet, just watching how he's conducted himself this entire presidency, whatever Vladimir Putin has on this dude is probably some stuff that you don't want to see.
Hmm.
It's probably, like, crazy and involves, you know, people and farm animals and you know, like boiling kettles or something. That's probably got, you know, it's probably something, you know, that if you see it, you know, you'll want to gouge your eyes out. It is probably that bad. Or he's got tax information or he's got like financial transaction information that, you know, if anyone were to see it here in this country, the Justice Department would have no choice but to be mobilized. And I'm still like, I'm still stuck at the fact that you met with the guy just days after Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein announced that 12 people that are employed by the Russian government as spies were being indicted for tampering with our elections. And here's the part of the Putin press conference that I don't think we're discussing enough. Putin wanted to question the people who did the investigation that led to these indictments. He wanted Trump to extradite them to Russia so that they could be questioned.
As in our FBI agents?
Yes, they wanted to question them. And now Trump didn't ask for the Russian agents to be extradited, which would have made sense. If you're absolutely going to go and see this guy, that would have been the first thing out of my mouth. Oh, okay. Hi. You know, want some coffee? Want a Danish? How about if you go and get those 12 people that we just indicted and put them on Air Force One? We'll take them back with us. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, and to your point, the fact that there was even a meeting after Rosenstein's indictments came out on Friday just suggests that you don't get the gravity of this situation. Now, is it political theater and probably some politics at play that Rosenstein chose to do this on Friday? Probably. I would think so. You know, I don't think that these guys are all just complete, that nobody is, that everyone in this, especially after the way the president has been laying into them, that somehow they're just still just so impartial and that that they don't have some bias. So did they choose this at a time when they knew it would come up and make his visit even more controversial? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. You know, I mean, they, you know, does it look like they did to upstage him? Probably. But you know what? So this is politics, right? And in politics, when a person sometimes puts you in a position where politically they got you painted in a corner, you have to back off and you just have to wait for a different opportunity because it's politics. They got you. After Friday's announcement, to your point, unless you were going there and you were going to bring this up publicly,
mm-hmm.
then you should not have gone. Because not to do so is to, as you said, is to undermine your own intelligence agency once again. It is to suggest then, I mean, whether or not it was would or wouldn't. I mean, the very fact that you were there and you, I mean, you know, you said he was forceful. Well, he was so strong and forceful. Mm-hmm. I guess he meant he was weak and ineffective since he's misspeaking. Is that what it means?
I guess.
You know, since everything is opposite. So everything I said, what you need to do is take it the other way. And speaking of that, GOP senator from South Dakota, one of the senators from South Dakota, Rounds, he gave an explanation that was almost as convoluted as Trump's would or wouldn't. He basically said, did you see his explanation about what happened with Trump and Putin?
No, I didn't. I've been trying to avoid this stuff.
Oh, well, his was interesting. He said that that basically it was like President Trump was essentially playing mind games with Putin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. His take is essentially that Trump knows Putin is lying and the whole world knows he's lying and that he's going to tell a lie with a straight face. So then he's just going to then play the same game with him. So I'm going to play your game, Putin. We're going to both act like we don't know, but you know that I know that you know that I know and that we all know. And that's what Trump actually did. So he didn't throw the intelligence agency under the bus. He didn't sell America out. He didn't back down, you know, and punk out on Putin. No, that was not what it was.
Mm-hmm.
This guy says it was like, a serious mind game that Trump was just messing with his head and you all don't understand it.
Well, maybe, you know, anymore, if you know, hear some of this stuff, you're like, you guys are really making it up as you go along, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I don't want to take anything from Senator Round. So this is what he said. Quote, I know you did it. This is Trump talking to Putin. Mm-hmm. I know you did it. You know you did it. And you know that I know that you did it. So to me, Mr. Putin tried to tell the whopper with a straight face. And President Trump basically laid out, you want to play that game? Fine. I can do the same thing because we all know you did. End quote.
Whatever.
Oh, man.
Because I'm like, you know, come on, guys. Some of us may have been born at night, but it wasn't last night.
Yeah.
You know, every time I sit and I think about the irreparable damage that this person has done to our country in just a year and a half. We're not even at the 2-year mark yet. And, you know, I'm thinking of the irreparable damage that he's done. And it just, I feel sorry for whoever becomes president next because they have the equivalent of a Superfund site that they are going to have to clean up. And I don't know if they have, you know, what it takes to do it because it's nuts. It's just nuts.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so absolutely. So, we actually now have, Denise, the third person. We were all speculating on yesterday who the third person was in the car, in the stabbing death of real estate developer Sean Schellinger?
Mm-hmm.
Schellinger, yeah. Sad story around on all parts. You know, two families obviously mm-hmm. will never be the same as a result. And but we actually now know who was in the car with them. For the longest, people were speculating, and John Belairs can now say, "Keep my name out your mouth," because it was not me. I told you all it was not me. He can go back to his life, although I got a feeling he's going to probably be branded forever.
Well,
that's how those things
John
are.
John Belairs is messy anyway.
Okay,
he's a messy dude.
But listen, one thing he cannot be accused of is mm-hmm. having been in that car and being the third person. So regardless of his other issues, whatever they may be, it was not John Belairs. It was actually a person by the name of Jacobson.
Mm-hmm.
Norris Jordan was the driver, who was a Philadelphia restaurant owner. And Yuri Jacobson was the third person mm-hmm. in the car with Norris and with Sean. According to Uri, who has now come forward, what is today, Wednesday? So I guess he can't. So we now know this Wednesday, the stabbing death happened on Friday. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So almost a week went by. And he says, according to him, that when they stopped in traffic, he got out of the car and he went over to another vehicle to try to get the car to move. And while all of this is happening, Sean and Michael, and I don't know if the driver was involved as well, got into whatever altercation it was that got physical and led to Sean being stabbed to death. He said then, Uri Jacobson, that he ran after who he thought stabbed Sean, but realized he was chasing the wrong person and then came back. Now, his attorney does not say, at least in the story that's reported in the Inquirer, does not say that he gave an account, doesn't say that he didn't give an account either to law enforcement that night. It does, the attorney for Norris, the driver, does say that he stayed with the police for 3 hours afterwards, which sounds normal. Mm-hmm. You know, you're a witness to a murder. I mean, far less things will keep you tied up with the police for an hour or two. And so that he was there at least another 3 hours with law enforcement, giving statements and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting about Uri is that his criminal background has come out. And I don't know if that's maybe a reason why he ran or we didn't know him for 4 or 5 days.
So basically, you had two people with criminal backgrounds rolling up on this black kid doing bicycle deliveries at night, and he's in jail for murder because he may have defended himself with a knife against these two guys.
Well, there were three in the car. So again, mm-hmm. but this is their story so far. And this is a court's going to have to wrestle with this. But mm-hmm. so the facts that we have is this. Some of the facts are these, that Jacobson, this third person in the car, would previously serve 30 years in federal prison for paying employees at his Bare Feet shoe stores under the table.
Oh, I'm familiar with Bare Feet.
Yeah. And so he, this is all according to there's a lengthy article in the Inquirer today. And they said that he did that to avoid paying taxes. So he did 30 months in jail. So he's a returning citizen. Some folks say he's an ex-con, right? He has mm-hmm. a felony record. He also was found guilty back in 1999, and sentenced to a year's probation for simple assault.
Now, what is simple assault? You know, is there like non-simple assault? And I know that sounds...
I'm not sure.
I know that sounds like a silly question to ask, but, you know, that term has always fascinated me.
Yeah. And so you have a person who has, in his history, legal history, having, you know, been convicted of simple assault, and who's done time. So you already have a person who, listen, if the shoe were on the other foot, he'd be being dragged right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to read all the way through the story to get to that part. The reason I'm focused on this is because what you said from the very beginning of the story is your interest is in how the media is going to report this.
Exactly. And that's what I've been watching the entire time.
Right. So I have to believe that. All right. So it says, this is the headline, which is third man in developer's car tells his story. So you go 1, 2, 3. Oh, you're into you're way down into the story before you get to the fact that this person had a felony record and that he had been convicted of assault. It takes a while to get there. Whereas very often when the story is about an African-American, suspect or a person of interest or a person who's a part of it, that kind of leads the story. Mm-hmm. Ex-felon was third member in the car.
Now, I was surprised that that's how that's what led that story. Because when you have developers, people with money, that kind of thing, we don't usually lead with their criminal records.
No, it did not lead with it.
Oh,
that's
it
my
didn't?
Point.
Oh, okay.
No, my point, that's exactly, no, I'm saying it did, you're right. It did not lead with it. You have to read all the way down in the story before you get to the fact that this guy had this criminal background. And I'm saying to your point that the stories that I've seen repeatedly over and over and over and over again, whether it be TV or whether it be print, when it's talking about a black person who's either a suspect or, like this guy, a person of, a person who was involved, at least present at that moment, who was missing, and now we find the person, it's ex-felon was third person in car. But that's not how this has been reported. It talks about how this guy, Uri, was at the memorial yesterday. His head was held down at the table, obviously in remorse, thinking about his friend who died. And it gives you all of this human part before it gets to his criminal background.
And see, that's what everybody really needs to keep an eye on. They need to keep an eye on how this is presented. Because what we're doing right now is seeing what the jury pool, a potential jury pool, is going to see. And if the potential jury pool sees this as a group of nice young men going out drinking that ended, horribly, rather than potentially seeing it as, seeing it from, the point of view of this young man who was just trying to make a living, the jury is going to act accordingly. And this is also another one of those things that, the fact that we tend not to, the fact that we as people of color tend to try to get out of jury duty however possible, that could have an impact here. Because the jury pool is picked from people who are on voter registrations, who have active driver's licenses, and who do a lot of things that sometimes, we don't necessarily want to do, especially the whole voter registration thing. This is another reason why voting is important, because if you're a registered voter, you get picked for jury duty. And if you get picked for jury duty, you have a chance to make sure that someone who looks like you isn't necessarily convicted by their biases, but by the evidence.
Well, now let me, and so speaking of that, so I just noticed something. So in the printed story, this is so interesting about the coverage. You all can look at this yourself. So I get the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News through, I actually get the I can see the digital version of the actual printed paper that you will get in your home or that you buy at the newsstand.
So you subscribe.
Also, yeah, because I got to stay on top. Look, I work with you, so I got to try to keep up. It's not easy, by the way. All right, trying to read stuff to keep up with Denise, I could never find a story that you don't know about.
Well.
But right. But Denise, look at this. So in the print story, it talks about Uri Jacobson's criminal background.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about Michael White's charge last year with marijuana possession, theft, and other counts that he was allowed to go into a diversionary program that he had to do community service and pay court costs.
Mm-hmm.
But what the printed story does not tell you is what the online version does.
Mm.
Oh, the printed version ends with Sean's memorial and what a nice guy he was. But in the online version, it says that Schellinger, the victim, had several brushes with the law in Pennsylvania and Florida in the 2000s, according to public documents. In 2001, this is in the article online, he was charged in Chester County with burglary, resisting arrest, criminal trespassing, and theft. The disposition of that case was not available. In 2008, he was charged in Okaloosa County, Florida, with battery and resisting detention. I guess I think in most places that's called resisting arrest, but okay, resisting detention. Court documents describe the disposition of that case as dropped or abandoned. In 2009, records show he was found guilty of disorderly conduct in Chester County. Why is it that these two paragraphs that are in the online version are left out of the printed version?
I really most people don't know. That doesn't make sense. That really doesn't make sense. And that's a good question.
So if you're going to put in the printed version Michael White's criminal background and Uri's criminal background, but then it immediately goes to speakers at Tuesday's memorial, talked about his outsized presence, love sports, his great, you know, being fiercely competitive and all of these things. But you don't, but you leave out, you bury a big part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
The person who got out of his car and who ended up being stabbed in an altercation with someone that people are describing as a chaotic scene had a history of brushes with the law that were violent brushes.
Yeah, because I believe it was after Monday's show, I got an email from someone who had all of this information about Schellinger's criminal background. And I'm reading through it, and I'm like, okay. On the one hand, I don't think you should put the victim on trial, but on the other hand, you know, this could be mitigation. And again, this goes back to the importance of seeing the video of this instance, because if you're going to tell me at 17th in, you know, in Rittenhouse Square that there was no video available, I'm going to look at you and say you are lying, because that place probably has video on its video.
Yeah.
And the video needs to show up. Somebody needs to see this, because that could clear up a lot. That could clear up a lot. And the thing is, I understand that you might not want to show that video to the public because it's part of a criminal investigation. But on the other hand, right now what you have is an incident that has the potential to really rip the city apart, because, you know, and I don't necessarily equate social media with what you see in the, you know, in the terrestrial world, but, you know, social media has been responsible for getting a lot of folks together for protests. And, you know, this has the potential to rip the city apart, and folks really need to work on this.
Well, I mean, absolutely. We can start by, you know, being consistent in how we cover, you know, all the persons involved in here. So if it's fair game to talk about one person in their background. So, I mean, on the one hand, you have, you know, the person who is arrested right now and in jail for being charged with the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And this person, his background, his brush with the law is having some weed and theft. And he's been put in a diversionary program. And on the other hand, you have the victim who has had, I mean, those are some pretty serious charges, right?
Mm-hmm.
Resisting detention, that's resisting arrest. That's not something to just shrug your shoulders at.
No. But,
and,
It's just my hope is that if we're going to focus on the criminal records of both the victim and the person who's accused of the murder, that we do so equally, because this has the potential, you know, to not go that way.
Right.
And that would be wrong, especially since you look at some of the folks that are Schellinger's friends. Like, among the people at his memorial service was Councilman Kenyatta Johnson. He lived three doors down from him. And I have no problem with that because, you know, that's your friend and your friends are your friends. But it all goes back to perception. And, you know, Ernest Owens, who appears with us on Mondays, has a column on, you know, on how close any young black man could be to being Michael White. Because of, you know, the fact that, you know, you're vulnerable if you're out there delivering food or whatever. And he said, you know, as part of this column that, you know, it kind of, you know, it said with all the, he says, what's more, with all, while all the information in this case hasn't surfaced, Councilman Kenyatta Johnson has already held a candlelight vigil for Schellinger and has spoken positively about him to the press. The same level of concern from elected officials wasn't given to local black victims, including the slain Brandon Tate Brown and David Jones, who were killed extrajudicially by law enforcement. And, you know, he's not wrong there. But the thing is, you know, this has the potential to turn into something really nasty if we don't see, if the community doesn't believe that all of the evidence is being, you know, utilized to make sure that it's fair. People don't mind losing a ball game if you're calling the balls and strikes the way they're supposed to be called, which is down the middle. They don't mind that. But if they feel like you're favoring one team over the other, then it becomes a problem. And yes, I'm sure that, you know, a baseball analogy was probably not the best one to use there. But, you know, there's already this perception that there is something that's being hidden from us because the video hasn't surfaced. And this happened in a place where everybody knows that video would have been everywhere because everywhere in that area has got a camera of some sort. And, you know, it's really time for the folks who are investigating this case to either let people know that they have acquired the video and are reviewing it now, or that they don't have it and they need it, or something. And again, and this also goes back to DA Krasner. He hasn't said a word about this case. And I understand that, yeah, you probably don't want to say anything about it because it's a, you know, a pending legal matter. But the very people who put you in that office are looking at you. I mean, yesterday, Asa Khalif called in and said, point blank, we are watching you on this. And, you know, what folks need to understand, you know, potentially, you know, when it comes to politics, is the same people who brought you to the dance will also make sure you're not invited again, depending on how you handle things. And if you're going to paint yourself as this progressive DA, you know, you need to kind of keep the public in the loop as to what you're doing and as to what's going on here.
Yeah, amen to all of it. I mean, you know, listen, this is the perception piece is so critical. I mean, and you're right, and that's why I appreciate your focus on the news media coverage of this. Because, again, I mean, I just look back. So the story was updated last night, the online story, just before 9 p.m. And it seems that that's enough time to get a print, to get that into the printed version. I don't print newspapers, but, I mean, I've seen stories in the printed version that happened late at night, you know, 10, 11 o'clock. Is that too late for the Inquirer to have updated the printed version that went to press that showed both of their criminal backgrounds, the victim and the alleged killer?
Well, it depends on when they print. You might not have seen it in the very first printing of the paper, which goes to places that are further out. but it might have been put in subsequent printings. I know that for the people I write for, if there's something that we can't get in on deadline day, we put it on the website just to make sure that people see it, and then we print it the next day in the paper. That might be what's going on here. But while the newspaper coverage of this trial is going to be important, the television coverage is really where the rubber is going to meet the road, because that's where, you know, a lot of perceptions are formed. And so far, you know, everybody's, like I said, everybody's been calling it down the middle. But, you know, as the trial begins, that's when it's going to get interesting. And remember, with everything that you read about this, you are reading this as a potential member of the jury pool. What is the jury pool seeing? And while you're not supposed to go into a case with your mind made up, we're human beings. And that's going to, you know, influence our perceptions, you know, when it comes to certain things. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in this case, you know, because if you're bringing up, you know, a marijuana conviction, you know, an ARD, and okay, that's fine, that's kind of relevant, but it seems like you're trying to take the narrative in a different direction than the, you know, college student trying to earn some money on, you know, on his summer break thing. And, you know, why did that come out now? Did it come out because we were also talking about Schellinger's criminal background? If that's the case, then fine. Then that's fair. But if it's just coming out for the sake of, you know, dirtying this kid and his reputation, you know, because, you know, the people, you know, you're going to have like the DA's office, which has like a bunch of lawyers and an unlimited budget to work with. Well, as unlimited as city council allows it to be. And then you're going to have a public defender or one. And actually, I just read this a few minutes ago, or one of the many lawyers around the country who have volunteered to represent Mr. White in this case, who may not have as many resources. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all shakes out. But what I really would like people to focus on is that, you know, in the end, this is a trial. It is, you know, in a court of law, and human beings are going to be making the decision as to what to exactly what happened here. Let's everyone keep their powder dry.
But that's hard to do because, listen, I mean, and that's the point. So, and even what you're talking about with TV and why it's so important. I mean, you think about how these narratives, I mean, the narrative for these two was written years before these two were ever even born. Right. I mean, they just step into the roles and it's automatically villain, you know, good person we're supposed to feel sorry for, regardless of anything else that we know about it, because that's just the way in which, you know, I mean, they're walking into, you can't discount history. You can't discount culture. You can't discount context. I mean, it's why whenever Michael Vick steps on a field, well, stepped on a field, you know, I don't think he's playing anymore, but no matter, in spite of the fact that he had paid his debt, in spite of the fact that he had turned his life around, in spite of the fact that he had, you know, had done everything he could to try to redeem himself from the dogfighting conviction, there was never a time that he was on the field in that game when that was not going to come up from some announcer, right? I mean, just always introduced as Mike Vick, the guy who went to jail for dogfighting. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I never, ever, ever hear anybody talk about Ben Roethlisberger's trouble with the law with women. Ever. Never hear it. Never, ever, 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 ever hear it. It's like it never happened. It's like that trouble in Georgia. Wash your hands. It's gone, Ben. It's all good. Mm-hmm. It's all good. And this, so the fact, so we have demonized an entire group of people, us. And therefore, Michael White does not just carry the burden of being accused of murdering this real estate developer. He walks in that jury, in that courtroom, with the weight of all of the rest of that hanging on him. We got to take a quick station identification break, Denise. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. If you want to join in, 888-329-3306, 888-329-3306. And we're also going to speak to Mr. Boots Riley about his new film, Sorry to Bother You, at about 8:20. We'll be right back.
WWDB Philadelphia, 860 AM.
You're listening to Mark and Denise in the Morning on 860 AM WWDB, a part of Beasley Media. Mark and Denise in the Morning is a product of Tyler Made Media, LLC.
Understanding. That's what the people need. And freedom. Helping us get all of that by way of Mark and Denise in the Mornings is a great sponsor of the show, Power. Philadelphians organized to witness, empower, and rebuild. Power is the region's leading faith-based organizing effort, working on issues like criminal justice reform, a 21st century livable wage, adequate and fair educational funding in Pennsylvania's public school system, climate justice, and so much more. Learn more about the work of Power at powerinterfaith.org and also the good people of JCW Computer Consulting. Joel Wilson, he's our Tech Tuesday guy. Just give him a call and ask Joel. He can help you with all your tech problems, and he can also sell you a great device at a reasonable price. Trust me, he can match or beat those big box stores for your next electronic device. Check them out at jcwcc.com or call them at 215-879-6701, 215-879-6701. Look, we're interested in your thoughts on this. I know that you all have been thinking about it, and I'm looking at social media, and so glad to see all of you all on this morning. Dave Lipscomb says that the narrative has been written. Yeah, that's what I agree. Yeah. And Mary raises the question, Mary Brooks, you know, he's a thug. I mean, right. So, I mean, it's if it was Michael White with the criminal background that the victim had, by now, certainly somebody in some publication would have called him a thug who took somebody's life, or a thug who brought his own demise upon himself, who had a history of starting trouble. Disorderly conduct conviction, disorderly conduct, I should say, resisting detention, resisting arrest, simple assault. I think people would be prepared to just say, oh, man, that guy got out the car and brought it on himself.
Well,
look at his record. Look at his record.
Much.
He's blacking. Look at that record.
Pretty much.
I'm just saying.
The level of sympathy wouldn't be there.
No.
And because, you know, you look at kids like when there's a documentary coming out about Trayvon Martin soon. It's a docuseries, actually, that is going to be running on the Paramount Network. But when he was killed, you know, folks just thought automatically, you know, he's a thug, he smoked weed, he did this and that, and didn't take into consideration that this was a guy who wanted to be an astronaut. He was going to space camp every year.
Mm-hmm.
And he was young. He was a kid. And you had 12-year-old Tamir Rice, so he was big for his age, who was brandishing a toy gun, which kids play with all the time. And he was shot to death by, you know, a cop that probably shouldn't have been on a police force anywhere because he had been fired from the last place he had gone to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot that we have to, you know, unpack as media people here.
Well, that's a lot that we all have to unpack. I mean, listen, I have said this before publicly, and it bears repeating in this moment. And I see Asa Khalif is watching this morning and listening. Asa's cousin was Brandon Tate Brown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so a number of us from Power had gone to Ferguson in the days following Mike Brown's killing, and were on the streets there, you know, got to experience the friendly welcome to Ferguson by way of tear gas and all of that. And we came back and, you know, we were doing die-ins with Power and joining with other groups who were protesting what was happening. And so I remember it was at the MLK Dare Coalition March, the first one we put together back in 2015, that January, that cold day. Mm-hmm. And there was a counter protest in our protest. We had about 7,000 people out that morning. Mm-hmm. And it was like 18 degrees. And there was like a small group with a bullhorn marching, weaving through our march, saying, "This is some bull. This is BS. Y'all ain't, you talking about Mike Brown, but you ain't talking about Brandon Tate Brown." And I mean, so we were kind of heated, like, you know, how dare you? And they got in our face and we were like, oh, you know, go on somewhere. And many of us had missed the story of Brandon Tate Brown because you know what? We drank the Kool-Aid. We believed that the narrative that was put out there. When Brandon Tate Brown was killed in December, I think it was the 15th, December 15th of 2014, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. I remember that morning seeing the video footage. Police killed a black man armed with gun in the car. And I saw the car, and it was a brand new Dodge Charger or Challenger, white car. Just, you know, everything supported a built-in narrative that I'm supposed to believe, and I didn't even question it. Oh, you know, he was dealing drugs. He was into some crime. He was doing something. I bought it. And it took, you know, folk like those young people calling us out and checking us. And to make us go back, and then it got me curious. I started looking in it, and I was like, wait a minute, this story doesn't make sense. Oh, wait, he was actually working at a rent-a-car place. That was a rent-a-car. That's one of the perks of working at a rent-a-car place. Mm-hmm. That's how he could afford to drive it. Oh, wait a minute, he had done time, but this kid just bought an apartment? Oh, wait a minute, wait. They said he was shot in the back of the head from one side of the car to the other while leaning in the car. Wait, was that a magic bullet that did a U-turn in midair and went and hit him? Now it doesn't make sense. But you know what? They had to shake us up and to wake us up out of what we were already prepared to accept without even hearing anything, just by images that we saw. So I want to thank those young people. And that's why I said that even within this story, I'm not prepared to just simply say that, you know, that the way in which this is going to probably try to play out is what it was. I mean, you know, it just seems like there's much more to the story, given the past of the victim and one of the persons in the car with him, that if it's fair to bring that up when the perpetrators are when people involved are black and people of color, then it's fair to bring up now. And it's very relevant to this case.
Yeah, I mean, especially since how this all began was someone getting out of the car to three people getting out of the car to confront one person, and it makes no sense.
No, Denise. Remember, it was three people who got out of their car to help a person in front of them move their car. Even how we portray that. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just say, I know I have been guilty of breaking this rule, I'm saying now, in my own past. But generally speaking, if you're in traffic and you know tempers are going to flare, just stay in your car. Just stay in your car. Because when three people get out the car, the way that this is being written and portrayed is, you know, these three guys just got out and were trying to help some old lady cross the street. And, you know, That's very nice to think that's what happened at 11 something at night, where there may or may not have been alcohol involved. Mm-hmm. And you got people who have in their criminal background issues with assault. It sounds more like, you know, three people got out, you know, and there's probably some yelling and fussing and, you know, and whatever else. I'm prepared to believe that and to hold that out as a possibility. That this was not just three saints who were just out walking around, and this kid on a bicycle rode, bumped into him and stabbed him and ran off. That doesn't sound very likely.
No,
narratives are important. Narratives are important. And yes, somebody just texted me something. I thought the same thing. I won't call out your name unless you want me to. But somebody just pointed out to me this. The family of the victim is not up in arms about this. Why not? That I thought about the same thing. Is it that they know? Do they know that their son or their relative kind of had a temper?
Well, I would think that the battery charge would say the dude had a temper.
I mean, seriously, isn't that a legitimate question? Thank you for the text. I had that same question. It's like, it seems to me that, man, if this happened to one of my family members, I'm telling you.
You haven't heard from the deceased family at all. I mean, you've heard from people who knew him. You heard from a woman in the Inquirer story on his memorial service that said he was like a son to her, that she was like a mother to him. But you haven't heard from his actual family.
His mom did say, well, so people are reporting what she said at the funeral and the memorial. His mom said that he had zero places in his heart for hate and told the crowd, this is who we all need to be. So the mom is speaking, and I think I heard, saw in the same story, the brother said something. Mm-hmm. In fact, the mom said, this all, the mother Linda said, two lives were lost in this disaster, referring to her son's death and White's imprisonment following the arrest. So,
yeah,
the mom, yeah, so you're talking about calling balls and, strikes right down the middle, that's where the mom seems to be. Mm-hmm. And so it just, I don't know, again, that, man, I'm just going to hold, because what I really want to say, I'm just not going to say right now. I want to see how this plays out.
Well, and I think that's what we should all do. I think we should all see how this plays out, because A, we don't really have a choice here, and B, people are going to be watching to just see how this is handled and use it as kind of a guidepost for how stuff like this is handled in the future.
Right.
That said, what you're seeing, because just some of the media coverage things that we're talking about is – that is an indicator of why diversity in newsrooms is important. And I think that sometimes, people who are, that we sometimes refer to as civilians in my business, don't quite understand why that is. Journalists of color catch a lot of heck sometimes for working in mainstream newsrooms, because there's this perception by many in the community that we're just adding to, how people of color are portrayed in the media or betrayed by the media in some cases. But if we're not there, if we're not in the newsroom saying, hey, wait a minute, are you sure that's the picture you want to run? And it's a group of black men in orange jumpsuits. Are you sure this is the picture you want to run? Or, this kid was a college student. How about if we put that in the headline instead of suspect? Mm-hmm. If it's not for those of us who are sensitive to those issues, being in the newsroom, and there's a lot of people, and when I say, diversity, I mean diversity of thought, diversity of opinion, in addition to racial and religious diversity. If we're not in the room saying, maybe you should think about this before you run it, or is there a better way we can illustrate this, or is this a better way you can say it, that sounds more like you're just calling balls and strikes, you're not trying to influence the game. Is there a way that we can say this differently that doesn't, imply that we've already decided what it's going to be?
Yeah.
And that's important.
No, it is. And the texter also added that the victim was also a former Penn State football player, where aggressive behavior is the norm. And he went on to say he's been protected because he was a football player. there's a lot more to this that I just think
Penn State can't catch a break.
Well, whether it's Penn State or not. I mean, whether it's Penn State or not, I mean, everybody knows football players. You know, you got to be aggressive to be a good football player.
It helps.
It's easy to get worked up. Mm-hmm. I just think, again, which is why I go back to saying that whether he uses a public defender or a private attorney, that whoever has this case, I would hope that they will have the resources and the time dedicated to really work this case. Because, again, it seems more and more each day that this sounds a lot like self-defense and not someone who went out trying to murder somebody, but somebody who feared for their lives. And I would hope that the person would be able to defend them in that way. So whether it's out of Kier's office or whether it's, you know, someone who steps up and volunteers or a GoFundMe account, that's what they ultimately get.
Yeah, because no one wants to put someone away for something that, you know, they did. Intent is the important thing.
Right. That's right. So Denise, in a few moments, we're going to talk to Boots Riley about his new film, Sorry to Bother You. Everybody on social media is talking about it. It's out in theaters now, so I encourage you to go out and check it out. And I spoke to Asa Khalif. They're actually meeting today. He's following up with that zoo story where the young man was arrested, 14-year-old. And hopefully we could get a report and some feedback from him on tomorrow about the outcome of that meeting and see how that turns out. And, we haven't talked about what you can't do. You know what you can't do while you're black?
Oh, we have another thing to add to the list.
I got one. It's petty, but it's mine. It's petty, but it's, you know, but I lived it. So Leslie and I just got back, from Aruba. It's her 50th. And, wanted to do it big this year. So, we're flying back yesterday on Southwest. And, I fly Southwest all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, So much so, it's like my only airline. So, you know, I'm A-list preferred. That means that I'm always able to get on pretty early. So I don't know. If you don't fly Southwest, here are the rules. It's open seating. First come, first served.
Mm-hmm.
So you're bored that way. You fly Southwest, Denise?
As often as I can, because that whole bags fly free thing just, you know, warms the cockles of my heart.
Oh, and you can change your flight. So if you got to cancel it or whatever, you can just change it. So it's a lot of love there on Southwest. So I've been flying them literally for, I don't know, 20 plus years, probably more than that. And so I know the rules and so you can save a seat for somebody. And if there's a whole community of people, this kind of splits frequent flyers on Southwest down the middle. There's a community that says you should never save a seat for someone. It's just rude. Mm-hmm. Then there's the other half that's like me that's like, are you crazy? If I'm flying my wife and I'm getting on before her, I'm holding her a seat.
Makes sense to me.
Looks kind of stupid for me not to hold a seat for my wife, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To appease you.
Yeah, especially like since, you know, this is your wife and you might want to sit next to her on the plane. It's logical to me.
So we're flying back and I get on the plane, hold the seat for her. And so it's emergency row seat, so extra leg room. So some white guy, and he's like, I want that seat. I'm like, no, my wife's sitting there. I said, but the middle one is open. You can have that one. She wants the window. I want the aisle, but the middle is open. You're welcome to it. But you can't save a seat. I said, yes, I can. And she's sitting there. You can have the middle, but you can't have that one. So he leaves and he tells on me.
Well, of course he did. Of course he did.
So the black flight attendant comes to me and says, you can't hold a seat. I said, I'm holding that seat for my wife. And so now, mind you, now I want to tell this to all my activist friends. Pick your battles. So I didn't take it any further than that. She just kind of, I want you to know you can't do that. And I'm like, all right, yeah, whatever. And so she goes on. And I don't say a word because I want to get home from Aruba. And flight attendants have a lot of power over you when you're on that plane. So don't start a scene until you land, okay? This word's for the wise. So once we landed, I wanted to make sure I went back online, looked at Southwest policy. There is no policy for saving a seat. They said they don't want to weigh in it, let people work it out themselves. And so sure enough, there is no policy. So I was right. I could save a seat. You may think it's, you know, bad etiquette, but I had a right to do it. And so I did it. Mm-hmm. So I went to the flight attendant. I told her, ma'am, you do know you just made that up. No, it's a policy. You can't save a seat on an emergency row. I said, show me the policy. Where is it in writing? I said, ma'am, I fly on Southwest every month. Where is the policy in writing? Matter of fact, give me your name. Because when I write and complain about it, I want your name so I can actually include it in my report on this flight. Ah, DaVita. Thank you, DaVita. So apparently, you can't even save a seat. So I guess he had so much fun in Aruba. All those black folk waiting and serving on you. Get on the plane, heading back to America. You think it's going to continue on. No, my friend. Stop it right now. Can't have that seat. But I did not want to get left in another country. So I chose not to say anything till we landed back in the U.S.
And I was getting off the plane. That's probably a good idea.
Oh, yeah, man. Because you're talking about petty, man. Those flight attendants will put you off in a minute. All they have to do is go say the magic words, I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe with him on my flight. Air Marshal, this man makes me feel unsafe. Can you believe that, though? This guy, he wouldn't have told. So why are you, like, telling? Seriously? I paid $15 to get on early. I'm like, dude, do you know how much I paid to be A-list preferred? Yeah, put your 15 bucks next to that. Snitch it. And I could have been a dry snitch, Denise. I could have been like Kobe. Because the lady right next to me, we got on at the same time. She was right in front of me, and she held a seat for her husband on the other side. I could have been a dry snitch and been like, she's holding a seat for her husband. But I didn't go out like that. I don't believe in dry snitching.
Well, that's good. No one should do that. That's bad. That's just bad.
I thought about it, but I didn't do it. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So I'm adding that to the list. It didn't get the cops called on me, but if I hadn't lived long enough to know where the logical outcome of that story was going, if I protested too much, you know, I know where it would have gone and the air marshal would have been called. Trust me.
Yeah. So I'm going to add it. You would probably still be in a foreign country trying to get home as we speak.
Yes. So I'm adding that to my list. That now becomes number HH on our list that has now continued to grow. You can't save a seat on Southwest if you're black.
I would think that with all of the lawsuits that the airline industry is settling for how they mistreat passengers, that Southwest, which is an airline that's been largely left unscathed by this kind of thing, wouldn't try to get itself put in the mix.
Well, but they're smart, because when I went back and read through the policies, basically what Southwest has said, they've kind of issued some statements around it, mm-hmm. is that, you know what, we just leave that on an individual basis. If we create a policy, it's only going to make things worse. And we just hope that people on planes can work it out themselves. I mean, this is my first time that anybody's ever really challenged me on that. I do it all the time. It's like, oh, my wife's sitting there, or my kids are coming behind me. Normally, if we're flying as a family, I take one of the kids with me. One sits on one row. Us on the other, you know, yeah, four kids. There have been times we've had to take two rows. And believe me, it's for your own good, people. When my kids were little and smaller, you did not want them spread out through the plane. You wanted them with me. Trust me. You may have been annoyed, but it was for your own good. Sorry, kids. Didn't mean to throw you under the bus.
Oh, and Mary Tibbs Brooks brought up another story that I saw that, you know, just kind of made me say, really, are you serious? The police were called to a basketball game.
Oh.
Apparently, there was a couple dudes were playing basketball, and one gave the other a hard foul. And the police were called because this person was given a hard foul. The recipient of the hard foul called the police.
Wait, I'm looking at this story now. Are you serious?
I am serious. I am serious. And I was like, I was like, are you serious now?
But did you see HuffPost, the subtitle of the article? This is the softest moment in the history of recreational sports.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel so bad now about the guy telling on me about the seat.
Yes, he, you know, this person was, the police were called on someone over a hard foul. Could you imagine if this person had been playing basketball in the era of folks like Charles Barkley, Charles Oakley, and guys like that? The police would have been on the side, you know, at center court, you know, with just about every play.
Wow. So here's the tweet thread from Trap Money Benny.
Okay.
Trap Money Benny. I don't even know what that's about.
It's trap money. You don't want to know what it's about.
Well, I know what Trap Money is about. I'm just like trying to figure out what that name is. But so Trap Money Benny was tweeting out about it. He was there. Mm-hmm. This is @_Togs, T-O-G-S. Today, for the first time in my life, I experienced someone call the police because they got fouled hard in basketball. He went on to tweet. He gets up, tells everyone he's going to call the police, and walks out, leaving everyone in gym confused. The next tweet. We thought he was joking till we saw Buddy at the front desk on the phone, really calling the police. Wow. And here's a picture of two cops talking to the perpetrator, apparently. I'm assuming that's the perpetrator. Big, tall, black guy. Looks like he could put a hard foul on you. And I guess that's the guy he fouled. White guy looks like about maybe 5'10". Black guy looks about like 6'6".
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one cop. The other guy works at the gym. The cop is like in between the two of them talking. What have we come to?
Well, you now know if you take to the court with this particular person that, you know, he's more of a ticky-tack foul person than a hard foul person, because you don't want the cops to, you know, be called back in for this kind of thing. Although, Dan says he should play soccer. No, actually, depending on who he's playing, you know, and what's his name? Neymar.
He kicked me.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the soccer and, you know, could you imagine how many people, you know, would get locked up for that?
Man, this just makes you just want to just stay away from white people.
Oh, my.
I mean, just for your own. I mean, I'm not trying to be, I'm just saying, just because I'm like, my God, what, you know, my looking at you or speaking to you may be perceived as a threat. And next thing I know, I may end up with the police in front of me. I don't even want to have almost any interaction based on this stuff. A pickup, a foul in a pickup game? Dude, are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that there was a cop on that plane, my man would have gone to him, because the flight attendant was not strong enough for him, even though she made up some stuff. He would have gone to the air marshal if he knew who the air marshal was. That
and
guy
they never
is
let you
seat.
Know who they are. They never let you know who the air marshals are.
No. That guy is saving a seat. Take him out. Tase him or something. Give me that seat.
Tase him? Over a seat? Really?
I'm just saying, look, tase him. Tase him up, man. It's like breaking social etiquette, at least for some people. I mean, look, we're calling police on people fouling in the gym. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Lord have mercy. What kind of foul was it?
I have no idea, but it was a foul, and the cops were called, and right. It doesn't make sense, and it's really kind of dumb, but, you know, it is what it is.
Well, one of my boys said that he should play badminton.
Badminton?
Yeah, because he got that little whiffle, did a little,
mm-hmm.
It's like, It's like tennis until you get ready to like hit that thing and it's like you realize this little soft thing. Yeah, badminton is a sport.
Well, I guess, but you know, contact badminton, you might get into trouble with that.
Wow. Well, listen, I mean, so we're waiting to speak to Boots Riley.
Yes.
And I'm sure he's doing interviews all around the country right now, so we're waiting on his call. And
no, actually, here he comes.
Is he on? Oh, good.
How's it going? Hi, how are you?
Oh, he's coming in. Excellent.
Please grab the mic. Hi.
Yeah, how's it going?
Not bad. Good morning.
All right. Make sure he gets his headphones on, Denise.
Well, he's got his headphones on.
Oh. Riley.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, this is Mark Tyler, who's my co-host.
How you doing?
I'm your homeboy, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's from Oakland.
I'm off of 98th and Golf Links.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe I know you by face.
Well, you know, I know you. You probably know all my family. So, I mean, I've been gone since 87, went to Atlanta for undergrad, and then moved all around. I'm back in Oakland. My kids were just there for the whole week with their grandparents, with my mom. So, but you know my brother, I'm sure. I see your circle, so I know that you all have been in the same crowd.
Okay.
You're about the same age. Man, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Just on this, you know, like Oakland to Detroit to Philly to New York, now back here, then going back.
Well, we
home
appreciate
tonight.
You coming out.
So it's, I'm, you know, trying to seize the moment and make it all happen, and I appreciate you. Y'all for, you know, seeing the movie and talking about it. And are we on the air right now?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
We are.
I'm glad I didn't cuss.
Yeah, no, now, Boots, this is, so let me just tell you about this station. It's a little bit more strict than other places we've been in the past. So help a brother out. Help Denise and I out. Hey, but, and we want to thank your sister as well for helping connect us as well. Shout out to Denise James, our good friend of this program.
Yeah.
She inspired us to start this show.
Yes. She's my older sister, my big sister. Mm-hmm. So,
Hey, Denise.
Yes.
Boots has a real Oakland accent.
I didn't know that such a thing existed.
We do. I've been in airports before across the country, and I hear somebody speak, and I'm saying, "Man, you're from Oakland, right? Yeah. How you know? I know. I you know, you leave, but you never leave home."
Yeah.
Boots, I want to ask you something before we talk about your film,
because
you know, you've been very active in hip hop and just in a lot of just conscious work. And one of the things that you did that just kind of stuck with me is you taught a class in a high school in Oakland called Culture and Resistance, Persuasive Lyric Writing.
Yep. That was over on.
What's that about?
That was at the School of Social Justice, which was actually housed in Allen Temple Church in, on 80 something and
85th.
And yeah, 85th and, International, as we call it now in, Oakland. And basically it was a writing class, and we studied verses of rappers. It was a high school class, actually. We studied verses of rappers and, you know, how we think, what we thought their thought process was as they were creating the thing. And so I wanted to give the students a goal of, you know, make sure that they had a goal when they were writing, and to give them an impetus around their aesthetic. And, you know, so it was a lyric writing class. It was almost a poetry class, in that sense. And, you know, talking about, lyrics and analyzing them. And what's crazy is that like three of the students, you know, 10th grade already had albums when they came in.
Wow.
You know, so that's how it, and that was, we're talking, this is 15 years ago now. So now people could make an album on their iPhone. So.
Well, I mean, that's how Chance the Rapper's career pretty much got started. A SoundCloud account and record your own stuff. And there you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so Boots, my wife and I, we just got back in the country, so your film was not playing where we were, and so we didn't get a chance to see it, but Denise has. I know she's got some questions
for
you.
Oh, yeah. First of all, when I met you Sunday night, I said there was a lot that I had to unpack about this film.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you haven't seen the film, it at least to me, it's kind of a commentary on the extremes of capitalism,
mm-hmm.
and what can happen to people when they follow those extremes.
Yeah.
And, it's kind of wild in places, but
yeah.
I guess my first question for you is, what inspired you to write this particular film, and what were some of the influences that you took that you used to like write this script? Because, you know, it's very creative at a time when Hollywood isn't really looking for creativity.
Mm. Well, I mean, they are now.
Well, yeah.
And what inspired me? I'm always looking for ways to talk about the things that I believe about the world. And the reason why I'm always looking for ways to do that is because, I think that there are ways that we can change the way things are, that the people can force the hand of power in order to do that. And, anyway, and that, so that, that further affects my view of the world, and I'm a creative person, so I just want to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And so, but I started out writing the movie as just taking place in the telemarketing world, and there was going to be a struggle that the lead character had to decide what side he was on. And as I decided to start talking about as I started talking about some of the bigger ideas in, you know, in putting scenes in context of other ideas, that's when some of the strange things started happening in the script, and just unusual for film. And I think that's what people are reacting to. It's actually like, it's actually taking off like wildfire in the theaters right now. And because people are seeing something new that they haven't seen before, and they're telling their friends, and other theaters are calling saying, we have to have this. So
how long has it been in wide release? Did it just come out on wide release? Or?
This past Friday came out in wide release. We did 805 theaters,
mm-hmm.
and that weekend we made 4.2 million. And so
nice.
You think about it like this: some other bigger, you know, meant to be blockbuster movies, like Uncle Drew. I love Lil Rel; he's real cool people. Mm-hmm. But Uncle Drew, they spent like tens and tens of millions on the promotion because they had Pepsi was backing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had 2,700 theaters, and they made $15 million. So this means – what all this means is that people are really getting behind this. Right now, we're a cumulative – not just to talk about numbers, but because some people want to know, are people buying into this? Do people like it? Are they seeing it and telling people to go see it? Yeah, right now it's a very small film, and it's made – 6.5 million right now. And I think that we're expanding this weekend to 1,050 theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
More people are gonna see this.
Now, are you surprised at some of the reactions that you've gotten? Because, you know, like I was at the screening I was at on Sunday, folks were like really buzzing about mm-hmm. this because you know, between I know that it's probably not fair to compare it to Get Out, but Get Out is the frame of reference that we have, particularly for black films.
And my ego won't let me not say that we published this screenplay as its own paperback book in 2014.
Oh.
And, you know, screenplay format, but bound as a paperback book on McSweeney's, which is a popular publisher. And it got packaged with the McSweeney's Quarterly and went out to 10 or 20,000 people. So that was actually how I got the buzz to start to get Sundance to get me, you know, invite me to apply for the Sundance Writers Lab and then the Directors Lab and all that kind of stuff. So I understand that for most people, Get Out might be their frame of reference. Like, here's something taking a different approach to talk about the issues that people go through, that black folks go through, and that we go through, period, in society. So that makes sense. I'm all for it. But again, like I just said, my ego has to let people know this is not a copy of.
In other words, you've been out there already.
Yeah, I mean, it's more just about, like, it's not, you know, like, we were already set to start filming before Get Out even came out. But, because what will happen with all of these is that studios will commission Get Out-like movies or Sorry to Bother You-like movies. It'll be that. That's just how film works, film world works. That's how entertainment works. That's how music works, all that. So,
okay.
So, Boots, we don't want to, because I know we don't want to give a lot of the film away. And again, it's Sorry to Bother You. It's in theaters right now, and he said it's going to be expanded to other theaters soon. But if you had to kind of give a synopsis, I mean, what's the heart and soul of
it? This is what I would say, is that this is an absurdist dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction inspired by the world of telemarketing. It's called Sorry to Bother You, and in it, Lakeith Stanfield plays Cassius Green, who's a black telemarketer with self-esteem issues and existential angst, who discovers a magical way to make his voice sound like it's overdubbed by a white actor. That white actor is played by David Cross. Hilarity ensues. But there's much more to it than that. But that's all I'll tell you about that. We'll also tell you that the story was so well loved that we got basically the dream team of actors to want to come make it come true. So we got Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Steven Yeun, Terry Crews, Omari Hardwick, Danny Glover, Armie Hammer, and Jermaine Fowler.
And they're all very good. And I kind of just wanted to ask a little bit about filming the movie itself. How long did it take to film? And you know, is it actually in Oakland proper where you filmed?
Yeah, we shot it 95% in Oakland, maybe 5% in Berkeley, which is right next door to Oakland. Mm-hmm. And we shot it in 28 days. There were 61 locations.
Wow. Can I ask you, before you answer the rest of your question, was that in Maxwell Park?
Yep. Okay.
I told my wife.
It was right around the corner from my house. I went and knocked on the door. I was like, we need a house with a garage like this, and knocked on the door. Door opens up, turns out to be my boy Tyranny, who's one of Marshawn Lynch's managers. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, use the house. We just had to buy his wife a couple days at the spa.
Wow. So that is how the whole, you know, deal making process is.
Yeah.
Get a house for a couple of spa days.
Well, he was like, I'm down. I just got to talk to the wife. I was like, tell her we're going to get her a couple spa days. And he was like, she's in on the spa days.
That's great.
That's how we got, one of the things about shooting in Oakland, we knew everybody. So I know everybody. No, I'm exaggerating, but I know almost everybody. And, so we got a lot of locations for free, a lot of artists. I mean, half of Oakland is in the movie.
Mm-hmm. And, And another thing that kind of, you know, got me about the story itself, particularly when we talk about capitalism, was like there was a company within the company, or a company that's talked about within the movie.
Worry Free.
We Worry Free. Yes, I was about to say to we company. Work, yeah. But I didn't mean that. But you know, Worry Free, where basically you have they provide all of the needs for their employees in a way that's not that when you look at it, you're like, this doesn't feel right to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess what inspired that? Or was it just something that you saw, you know, happening in capitalism altogether that you thought that this was, you know, the logical, the least logical step?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting because I think what inspires that is this idea that the new capitalism there is no capitalism here.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it is like. This is not a workplace. This is a beanbag room where you get on the internet and do things for us. I'm not your boss. I'm your friend that tells you what to do. You know, so an extension of that, an exaggeration of that is like, this isn't slavery. This is guaranteed meals and work and housing, right? So. I think that it's just an exaggeration of what actually is happening. I don't even know if that company that we have in there, which is basically slavery through all of this stuff, I don't even know if it's illegal under capitalism. I mean, right now, if it's illegal under the laws we have right now.
Wow.
It would be I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying I don't know. And I don't think anybody right now can give a definitive answer, but it would be a great research project for someone.
Yeah.
Now,
so, hey,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, Denise. Let me just ask this, Boots. So a lot of folk, you know, are buzzing about the fact that now with this film, two of the, I guess, like hottest black films this year, Black Panther and your film, Sorry to Bother You, are both written by and directed by, directed by black directors out of Oakland. So, yep. I mean, have you and Ryan Coogler had a chance to talk?
Oh, yeah. Ryan Coogler, although he's a good 10 or 12 years younger than me, is one of my mentors. And because he was doing film before I was. And often lent an ear to the problems that were happening along the way in getting the movie made. And it's a friend of mine. So
now, actually, someone asked me to ask you this, and what they want to know is how you ended up with the title Sorry to Bother You. Because after you sit and you watch the movie, you know, on the one hand, yeah, it does talk about telemarketing, but on the other hand, it goes way beyond that. So what made you decide to make that the title of your film?
It is what telemarketers often say. But also, the movie presents some views about life that are true, but yet not necessarily always talked about. And sometimes when you shake people from their understanding of the status quo, it feels like an annoyance,
mm-hmm.
or it feels strange or whatever. So they feel bothered, right? Like if somebody tells you, you know, I don't know, something about a friend of yours that is doing something wrong, you know, like mm-hmm. it can be a shock or something like that. So kind of disturbing people out of a state of of not, and not really that people don't know what's wrong, but people don't know that they can do something about it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, hey, Boots, real quick, can you also talk about the transition from going from, you know, a whole life of hip hop? I mean, you got a long, I mean, man, people don't even know that's an entire, we could spend a whole show just talking about that. But how do you make that transition? Is this different, or do you think that this is, you're still telling the same message, but using film as a different medium?
It's all one big creative mishmash to me in my head. And, you know, more important than just being a hip hop artist, I was a producer all that time, and we use live instruments. So what that meant is, as a producer, I'll be in the studio and I might have the best bass player in the world sitting right there in the studio with me. I might have the drummer that thinks he's the best drummer in the world, but definitely is not in the studio. There, he's definitely not the best drummer in the world. And then I might have the crazy guitar player that has ADHD and text in all caps, and they may each know way more about music than I do. And they definitely know way more about their instrument. But I'm the one that has to have the vision, and not only have the vision, get them to buy into that vision to help me fulfill it. I need to know how to communicate with them and get them to see the special thing that they have to make this vision happen. And then I also have to know that the guitar player is probably always going to want to have a guitar solo, even if that makes the song worse. And that, so that his opinion of what needs to be done is biased by his agenda of what he wants to do. Separately, I need to also know that when the bass player hits a bass lick that's way better than what I did or what I had. And I need to not attach my ego to each little thing, but attach it to getting the song finished as a whole. Now, that's exactly what you do as a director.
Okay.
Well, perfect. All right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And movies in theaters right now.
Right. Go see Sorry to Bother You. And also catch the soundtrack album, which is done by The Coop.
Yeah, soundtrack album. The new, there's a new sound. So just to be confusing, after I finished the screenplay in 2012, we made an album called Sorry to Bother You, which was inspired by the screenplay. There's now The Coup has made a whole new album that is that is called the soundtrack to Sorry to Bother You.
Mm-hmm. Just so there's differentiation.
Yeah. And, we got Janelle Monae on a couple songs.
Nice.
We got Killer Mike, E-40, and Tune Yards on there.
Wow.
And Lakeith Stanfield. The single is out right now. The album should be out on Friday.
Okay, great. Well, so much again for coming in and talking to
thank
us.
Thank you.
And thanks for putting out a really good, really creative film that we are all going to be talking about for a while.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for helping us get it out there.
Oh, no problem.
All right. Hey, and since Quarter Pounders are all closed, just get a Nation's Burger for me next time you get home.
They're not all closed, though.
They're not?
No, the one on 80th between, what was that, 81st?
One East on 14?
Yeah, that's still open.
All right. I'm going to have to go down. That's my spot.
Yeah. And there's one on MacArthur over by High Street that's still open. I don't know if it tastes the same.
No, I tried that one last time I was home.
Yeah.
All
right.
All right, Boots. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peace.
Have a good
morning. You too. All
right. Yeah, check it out. Listen, it's the hashtag for the film is hashtag STBY. Let's get that trending and make sure that you go see it. We want to make sure we support independent films like this. And, hey, Denise James, thank you for hooking us up with your younger brother. We sure appreciate you for making this happen. Denise has been telling us about this film for some time, right, Denise?
Yes, she has. I mean, because she's a proud big sister, and she should be, because this is a really good film. And like I said, you need to go see it with a group of your friends, because you're going to want to talk about this.
Well, I can't wait. I'm going to, like I said, now that I'm back, you know, in the States, I got to check that out ASAP. And I'm just telling, just by, you know, Asa Khalif said it was a powerful film. He weighed in. And I've heard more than one person, Denise, like yourself, say that you're going to want to talk about it after it's over. And I have to go back and listen to the podcast to actually hear him break down what this film is about, mm-hmm. because that was so deep. He kind of lost me halfway through.
Yeah. But it's at the Riverview right now on Delaware Avenue. And there are several showings, and you should really check it out, because you're going to want to talk about this.
Well, here's my big question, Denise. When you went to see it, were people in there talking back to the screen?
Not that I can remember, but, you know, there were a couple of times where, you know, you could tell that people were really, really paying attention to it, because Chris and I went. And, you know, for Chris, you know, he thought immediately of Octavia Butler's The Parable of the Sower, and how that probably figured in on some level, you know, to with this movie. And, you know, we, like I said, we talked about it, you know, in the lobby for at least like half an hour, 45 minutes afterward, because you're going to want to talk about this.
All right. Well, listen, I tell you, tomorrow, speaking of things to talk about, which you don't want to miss, we'll be speaking to former Mayor Wilson Good, first African-American elected to the office of mayor in the city of Philadelphia's history, and also the mayor at the time of the MOVE bombing. And he's got a new book out entitled Black Votes Mattered. And so we'll talk to him about that. About his time as mayor, and certainly we're going to, you know, want to spend some time talking about the MOVE bombing as well. So not want to miss
you
that.
You kind of can't avoid talking about, hey, do you remember that time you blew up an entire city block?
Mm-mm. my memory's foggy there. What are you talking about?
Well, I can take you to the marker that's dedicated to it on the street.
No. So, yeah, but again, so this is one of the things we'll be talking about. And, you know, he said it's fair game. So we will, bring that up on tomorrow. So, you certainly want to wait. You want to be, a part of this conversation on tomorrow for sure. Mm-hmm. Want to thank, Boots Riley again for coming in today and encourage you to get out to the theaters to see that film. Want to thank Dan Fritz for holding the board down. It's not easy doing this when I'm in one place, Denise is in another. So even though I'm back, just couldn't get into the studio in person this morning. So want to thank Dan for holding that down, as well as Leslie for taking care of all of our social media. Want to thank all of you out on social media. I'm telling you, man, you guys were big today. Thank you to all of those. See Chris Murray out there, Melinda, Hervey, Yolanda, Albert, and so many more. Donnie D, Sheila, the whole crowd, the whole gang is here. Thank you for contributing and making this show what it is. And I guess, Denise, that's pretty much all we have today.
Yeah. I mean, if we're going to go out, you know, with, you know, a good filmmaker talking about a really good film.
There you go. Okay. Hey, that's it for us today. Have a great day. The weather's supposed to be a lot nicer than it has been, a little bit cooler, but still going to feel like a good summer day. Mm-hmm. So go out and do something nice to yourself. And until tomorrow, we're out.
Have a good day, everybody.